Welcome to All About Art. My name is Alexandra, and I'm an art historian, curator, and writer. Within this podcast, topics relating to art history, cultural policy, the art sector, as well as a large range of other art-related topics will be covered. Conducting critical discussions, having entertaining exchanges, or just enjoying some relaxing chats? All About Art is where you'll find it all. Join me in exploring and developing cultural discourse. Welcome to another episode of All About Art. In this episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Fatos Üstek. It was announced that Fatos would be curating this year's Frieze Sculpture, a major annual public art exhibition that places monumental works by leading artists throughout London's Regent's Park during Frieze Art Fair, one of the biggest art fairs in the world. Listen on to hear me ask Fatos about her background in mathematics and how it influences her curatorial approach. We of course talk about Frieze Sculpture 2023, as well as other projects such as Frank, Fair Artists Pay, an initiative she launched this year with two artists. We delve into her ideas for new structures for arts organizations and what Fatos envisions for the future of the arts sector. I also ask her about the experiences she's accrued being on the jury and in advisory roles for the Turner Prize, the Fourth Plinth, Jarman Film Award, and New Contemporaries, to name just a few. Thank you, Fatos, for coming on the podcast and having such an amazing conversation with me. Thank you to our sponsors at Synergy Associates, the art world tech gurus, for supporting this episode's production at their clubhouse on Pall Mall. You can find more about Synergy and their facilities in the show notes. Before I dive in, I wanted to let you lovely listeners know that All About Art is on Patreon. So if you want some behind-the-scenes content, maybe a bit of merch, the chance to get one-on-ones with me and my guests, or you're simply wanting to support this project, I would be absolutely thrilled if you decided to sign up. You can do so through the link in the show notes. I also wanted to say thank you to those who have already signed up. Your support means the world, and it makes the further production, improvement, and growth of the podcast possible. And for that, I'm incredibly grateful. And now, on to the interview. Welcome to the podcast, Fatos. I am so thrilled that we were able to get together for an episode. This is an incredibly exciting time, as it was announced in December last year, so 2022, that you would be curating this year's Frieze Sculpture for their 20th anniversary. You have vast expertise in curating, writing, and leadership, along with your jury and advisory roles for the Turner Prize, the Fourth Plinth, and Jarman Film Award, to name just a few. I mean, amazing. While also being the chair of New Contemporaries. You have such an impressive career within the arts, and not to fangirl too much right out of the gate, but I'm really looking forward to discussing all of this with you here on All About Art. But first, I want to start us off just to give listeners a little bit of an introduction to you. I would love to ask you about your background and how you started in the arts. You studied mathematics in Istanbul for your BA and then came to London and studied contemporary art theory for your master's at Goldsmiths, right?
Exactly.
That's also my alma mater for my master's.
Oh, yeah. That's amazing. When
did you know that you wanted to work in the sector, and how has your professional journey been thus far?
First of all, thank you very much, Alexandra, for having me. It's really a pleasure to be in conversation with you. And thank you for this beautiful question. So I was a hardworking, I'll take you a bit far. I was a hardworking high school student and with a keen eye on reading. So I was always like so much inspired by Ingeborg Bachmann, is an Austrian writer, and associated myself with the way she lived. And I envisioned myself like living outside of Turkey, you know, on my own in a rooftop flat, and where I would write, read, engage with life as, you know, Bachmann did. And I even imagined that my fridge would be, you know, like Bachmann's empty fridge of, you know, lack of nutrition and only like a half-bitten burger on the shelf. I mean, I have a different relationship with food right now, so I'm actually pleased and much more healthier, I guess. But, you know, when I was at high school, I didn't really foresee myself like working in the arts or making exhibitions. I didn't grow up surrounded by art, nor, you know, there was actually any kind of appetite in my family and my wider family to kind of like follow artists or see exhibitions. So it was not a, you know, like a familiar world. the term curator was very new during my college years in Turkey. It was still like in that kind of like transition phase of how do we really understand what a curator is, you know, in the context of like late 90s. So I started working at Istanbul's festivals as an assistant. So from like theater festival to film festival, from the biennial to, you know, jazz festival, etc. So I would always kind of like be part of the festivals and, you know, also kind of like explore, you know, different cultural production from you know, artists, visual or performing artists. And I think I had a double life during my studies because I was juggling work at, you know, like working at institutions as an assistant or as an exhibition coordinator, and then, you know, balancing it with my proof-based mathematics as my studies. And your question is like very beautiful in the sense that like it is, you know, like I really believe in that, like it's almost like Hemingway also writes like that, you know, things happen gradually, then suddenly. So I do have a crystal clear day that I've decided to commit to art.
Do you really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, I love that.
I mean, yeah, no, I do. I mean, but also, of course, there was that gradual accumulation.
Yes.
But
yes.
So, you know, I was an outsider in the art scene in Istanbul, even though I worked closely with artists. I worked with them in production or helped them in, you know, their funding applications because I studied English from the age of 12. And so that was also quite good to kind of like really translate texts and publish in Turkish magazines or outlets, etc. But I was always an outsider as well because people thought that I was just, you know, like doing it as my college hobby. And once I, you know, graduate from college, because I was also working, I was studying in a quite a good university that always have these like graduates go on to like big positions, etc. So there was that kind of, I think, disbelief in me sticking to it. And I also, you know, my family was also very adamant to my, you know, dreams of making up in the art world. And, you know, there's always that kind of like projection of, oh, you know, you will suffer. It's such a bohemian life. And
yeah.
You will end up drinking cheap wine and living on the streets, kind of. So I was literally that day was so crystal clear because I had quite a tough experience. And it was literally, I was, you know, like working on a project with a colleague and had quite an upsetting push out of the project. And then that was actually for me kind of like poignant in the sense that it really shook my beliefs of like, okay, I will make it in the arts. I felt like I have to make a decision. And I was pulled in two sides. On one side, you know, like my family was saying, okay, you have to secure your life and, you know, do it as a hobby. And on the other side, I had that fire in my belly that I actually, I don't know, that kind of like, you know, glimmer of hope of, okay, I have this, I have some burning desire to work with artists, that passion. And that day I was walking on like one of the most crowded streets of Istanbul. It was like 2003. And I decided, okay, I'm going to, you know, like give my 100% to art. And, you know, like I won't abandon my dreams until, you know, it proves me so. So since that day, I only actually looked back once. And that was also when I resigned from Liverpool Biennial. And which was like a defining setback, but also at the same time, an incredible growth experience for me. And so far my journey has been filled with, you know, truly astonishing experiences of working with artists, curators, writers, creative practitioners, but also dealing with hardships, you know, like in making it happen in a world that I wasn't accustomed to growing up and in countries that are not my birthplace.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that amazing answer and for really going into depth, because I think that when we in the arts open up about our experiences in entering into the sector, I think there is very often a universal experience of parents being quite discouraging, of saying, you know, how will you make money? How will you, you know, how will you make a living out of this? And I think it's amazing that we're here to prove everyone wrong in that sense.
Yeah. And I have proud parents now, so that's good. They still don't know how it happened.
And they probably don't know what you do on the day to day, but you know, we're getting there.
Absolutely.
So when it was announced that you would be curating Free Sculpture 2023, you stated that, quote, encountering art in the public realm gives us an experience like no other. At its best, it can astonish, inspire awe, and create collective wonder. And I really, really loved that quote from you. And I wanted to know, what type of experience would you like to offer through this opportunity? And is there a specific theme that you're aspiring for or a goal that you have in mind for your visitor experience?
Throughout my career, I loved working with a carte blanche. And I'm very thankful to Eva Langret, the director of Frieze London, in supporting me to build a new vision for Frieze Sculpture, you know, which marks the 20th anniversary of Frieze London this year. And also it's the 11th edition of Frieze Sculpture happening. So over the last months, I've been reflecting on, you know, what sculpture is as a medium and how do we receive and interpret sculpture today, and what is the difference between what we see today as sculpture from the initial conception of what sculpture was? So, you know, like that kind of like immediate corporeal bodily experience, you know, like sculpture is the first medium that has that immediate connotation of our experience of being in our bodies. So I'm approaching sculpture from an expanded notion where audiences will experience a wide array of artworks that pronounce the contrast between the monumental and the ephemeral. And additionally, I'm bringing in artists and artistic practices that work with aspects of other media, such as sound, light, performance, AR, VR. And I believe that, you know, like the experiences that we are cultivating for the audiences this year will be very much informed by conceptual approaches and also explorations of materials that are other than bronze and marble, which we also have. We have 21 artists that are showcasing practices that come from like established backgrounds or historical names, as well as like young artists or artists, you know, like still established and mid-career, but have never shown work in the context of a public realm.
So
I can only say that we are truly excited about this year's edition and cannot wait to share with you all.
Oh, I'm so incredibly excited. Free Sculpture has a bit of a special place in my heart because when I first moved to London, I had kind of, you know, a leading up to wanting to be in the arts, but then I had one day where I looked up jobs you could do in the arts and I went to my mom and I said, I know what I want to study. I know what I want to go into. I want to work in this sector. And so without really growing up with much knowledge about the arts, I moved to London to study art history. And one of the first big things that I encountered was Free Sculpture. I didn't even know what Free's art fair was, but I was walking through Regent's Park because I went to UCL, which is very close to Regent's Park. And I was walking through the park and I saw all of these huge sculptures and I was like amazed. I was like, I love London. How wonderful is this? Oh my goodness. And I was just so engrossed by what was happening. And that is why, you know, public art is so, so instrumental in reaching different audiences and also making art incredibly accessible to people. It's so important.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And there's also like, you know, there are kind of like benefits and also like, you know, challenges of art in the public realm.
Yeah.
But I really agree with you about that immediacy of the art encounter. But also at the same time, it's challenging for the artwork itself sometimes because you're really stripped bare of any of your comforts, you know, like you don't have a room, the temperature can't be controlled, and the relationships with the artwork is not choreographed as much as in, you know, like white cube spaces or museum contexts.
Absolutely. You kind of lose that specific context where you almost have this opportunity to inform a little bit more in case something like that might not be, you know, this like primary stratum of meaning that you can unfold by looking at an artwork, which often happens with like very figurative pieces of art, right? It's very easy to kind of get some type of meaning out of that. And sometimes with more conceptual pieces, it's a little bit more difficult. But that challenge and that like introspection about an artwork is actually, in my opinion, what makes it so rewarding to engage with, you know?
Absolutely. And it can also take you away from your, you know, like everyday hurdle. Like literally you're walking into something and then, you know, surprise is the only emotion that could switch our mood, the way we feel ourselves. If you're attached to something or if you're, you know, having an aversion to some other feeling and a thought, then you're surprised. It can flip you. And I think, you know, like art in the public realm could have that potential.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And you've been commissioning in the public realm for over 2 decades now, working on a number of large-scale festivals, which is what you talked about earlier, very briefly in the beginning, such as directing the Liverpool Biennial. You were also the associate curator for the 10th Gwangju Biennial, or Biennale, which is an interchangeable word.
Exactly.
Just in case people listening might not know that. And curating Art Night in 2017, which you mentioned to me that you treated like a mini biennial. What have you learned from these past 2 decades working in the public realm? And how will free sculpture be different, but also maybe how will it be similar?
Mm-hmm. So recently, I've been reading a lot of Carlo Rovelli and his books. So Carlo Rovelli is a quantum physicist, and that I actually will be collaborating with him on Thursday this week on the occasion of a symposium that we're organizing at the Mathematical Institute in Oxford.
Which we'll talk about later on.
Okay, yeah. Sounds perfect. Sounds great. But, you know, Rovelli argues that time is local and that there is not a universal time. And our understanding and experience of time is relative and dependent on where we are. So if you live in a plain or in a mountaintop, you experience time differently and you age differently. So I kind of like draw parallels between, you know, Rovelli's conception of time and the public realm. So for me as a curator, context is everything. And when you're curating and it is independent of the public realm or white cube environments or the digital interfaces, you need to kind of like think about, you know, like what are the dynamics of a place? And besides the difference between regulations in each country, you know, like that, you know, like in Korea, there are different regulations than in the UK. Health and safety in the UK is particularly significant, I would say, than, you know, like working in Turkey. And that, you know, like these kind of like, let's say, contexts or these kind of thinking about the fact that the public space or the public realm is local, then makes you really identify what the context is and what your scale of ambition is and also what is the potential. So you need to do a lot of like observation and thinking, but also gathering information. It could be research about the history of the location. So I was looking at, let's say, for Frieze, like the amount of like trees in the park and the age of the trees and the make of the trees.
Oh my goodness, you know, I like, love this.
And how they blossom, how they grow, how they react to temperature, humidity, but also the history of the park as well itself. Like what was its use in the centuries before this became the Regent's Park, and what is its use today? So I've been spending a lot of time, you know, like observing people, you know, like the runners or mothers with buggies or, you know, like people in costumes celebrating birthdays. And so it's very important that, you know, like that kind of observation and also like knowledge of the research that you bring along really helps you to identify what kind of artworks would redefine the place here. So for instance, for this year, we've actually commissioned new works that are site-specific and site-located or site-adjusted.
Wow.
So it's not only like retrofitted existing objects coming in in a kind of like a temporary gathering togetherness, but it's also about like artists have been thinking about the kind of like the dynamics of the park, the context of the park, and then responding to it with hopefully, you know, quite meaningful artworks.
Oh my goodness, that sounds so incredibly exciting.
Thank you.
I cannot wait to come by and see it. Oh my goodness. So moving on to my next question, also in terms of how you decide to approach the work that you do, how does your upbringing in Turkey and professional career working across Europe influence your practice, if at all? And will audiences of Frieze be seeing glimpses of this in your curatorial style in Regent's Park?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really striking question. I think, you know, short answer would be absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, our backgrounds of, you know, of a specific geography, education, to really inform who we are. And also all the experiences we have accumulated through time define our ways of being in the world. So I'm a conceptually driven and artistically passionate curator. And I'm drawn to complex inquiries in artistic practices. I'm very much interested in building layers and multiple threads in exhibitions that I curate. So those layers not only, you know, proliferate access points for a wide variety of audiences, but also supports the contextual reproduction of art experiences, art encounters. So I guess, you know, like having studied maths as an undergrad or being born in a country with, you know, social political hardships definitely informed the way I see the world.
Yeah, yeah, of course. I think that that's so understandable in, I guess it would be so, I don't want to like say it would be so silly, but like if someone would then make a statement and say that they weren't affected by of their upbringing, I think that that's quite a closed-minded way of looking at things because we always bring in our past experiences. That's what makes us us. That's what makes our thought processes what they are. That's what makes us perceive things in certain ways, interpret them, and feel certain things in reaction, which I think is incredibly important from a curatorial standpoint. And it's that age-old idea that artists have to deal with in terms of letting your artwork go out into the world and not being able to control how people will react to it then.
Absolutely. I mean, it's also like when we talk about identity, it's not only like the land or the culture or the customs and the habits and behavior, but it's also the smells, the sounds that you grew up being surrounded by.
Yeah.
And the perspectives, the reactions of people around you to, you know, things that are awesome or that are, you know, disgusting. So you learn these concepts also in the culture.
Yeah.
Same thing with, you know, like whatever you expose yourself to learning really becomes a filter in your mind, in your ways of relating to the world. So for me, like maths in that sense, beside being a formation, is also a language that I've learned, you know, like a form of thinking that I think still informs the way I curate, especially working with space or working with, you know, the dynamics of uncertainty.
Yeah. I think it's also interesting to think about the right and left brain and how we deal with creativity versus also that logical thinking and bringing that together to form something within your own creative practice. Moving away from Freeze and just to other amazing projects that you have worked on or are working on actively, another initiative that you launched is Frank Fair Artists Pay, with artists Anne Hardy and Lindsay Sears. The platform intends to pioneer a much-needed change for fair practice and fair pay for artists in the UK. Can you tell our listeners what the mission of Frank is? And I would also love to ask in that same vein, how can people support this? And also, what is the business structure like in terms of working with cultural organizations and cultural practitioners?
Thank you. I mean, Frank is another passion project that actually started in the wake of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And that brought myself, Anne, and Lindsay together to imagine change happening in the art sector. You know, that's a very long needed and necessitated change. But our approach is from a semantic, philosophical, and practical point of view. And we really want to kind of like, in a way, catalyze a mind shift to happen unilaterally. So we don't side with artists, we don't side with institutions or commercial galleries or funding or bodies. We actually want to bring everyone together around a conversation about what fair practice is and how it could be applied in a day-to-day practice of institutional commissioning or artistic labor.
Listeners obviously don't see me, but I'm like nodding my head like, yes, that sounds so good. That sounds so necessary. You're not siding. You're looking at all the moving parts within a sector because they all contribute invaluable things to the sector, don't they?
Absolutely. And if we will rise, we will rise together.
Yeah.
You know?
Absolutely.
So that is very important. So in that sense, you know, like, we are not building a manifesto at Frank saying, you know, like, this is not working anymore. But we are kind of like trying to build applicable solutions for art institutions, funding bodies, artists, commercial galleries even though they don't pay fees to their artists, but they can still stand upright for their artists when, you know, like, the artist is working on a new commission or doing a large-scale retrospective, etc. We're kind of like interested in, you know, like, guiding everyone with fair practice. And what that means is not only fair remuneration, fair pay, but it's also about, like, fair working conditions and fair contracts, because that's another kind of like a knot in the system. And at the moment, you know, we are polishing off our initiation year deliverables. So we have Frank's principles that are going to guide everyone what fair practice is and how it could be embodied in an institutional or artistic framework. And we're also working on artist questionnaire, which will support artists and as well as institutions in negotiating their collaboration and also building the contracts that they will be signed to seal, you know, their collaboration. At the same time, we're also working on building a Frank conceptual fair pay calculator. So it's like, unlike, you know, Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, there will be a computer, you type everything and it says, okay, 42, go for it. We won't generate numbers. We won't say, okay, for this amount of work, you are eligible to be earning, you know, £1,000, £6,000. But it's more a conceptual framework. Again, mm-hmm. like, we are attacking the mindset of, you know, like, what fair means. So in that sense, you know, like, the conceptual fair pay calculator will kind of like show the scale of working hours, professional commitment that is required in any collaboration. And it's about us, like, wanting to demystify what artistic labor means and invite everyone to see artists as professionals.
Yes.
So that is so important because, That's still not in practice. You know, like, today we are working with rates that are living wage rates or teaching rates. And we have no problem whatsoever if an artist is receiving a teaching rate when they are teaching in a, you know, like, alternative or accredited school, or if they get a living wage rate when you're working as a worker. But when they're employed as an artist, I think there has to be, you know, like, a specific kind of level of recognition mm-hmm. of their professionalism, you know, like, and the experience that they bring to the table. So regarding our business model, I think we were quite ambitious and also, you know, like, kind of like optimistic to think that, oh my God, this is really going to be picked up by everyone. Because what we're trying to do is really, as I said, it's really kind of like more of a unilateral uplift. So it's not about, like, creating more segregation in the sector or say, oh, this is not working and this is not working well and this is really worse than others. So,
yeah.
Like, the kind of, like, cancel culture is operating these days.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Or, like, just to jut in, when, and I don't know if you're of the same opinion, but for me, I've worked in commercial galleries and I have put in so much work in putting on exhibitions, right? And so when people say, oh, I don't think that it's fair to pay this person this much and the artist this much and the artist should get so much more, mm-hmm. I definitely think the artist should get a fair pay. But when you're working at the levels that I've worked at at the price points that I've worked at, they're getting, like, it's fair. But we also need to think about paying our staff fairly. And we need to think about, you know, all the costs that go into an exhibition, the fact that we have staff doing the marketing, doing the research, doing the PR, but also doing, like, the registrar, the logistics, all of that, organizing hotels, organizing people coming, like, all of that is what we do in a gallery. So there's also fair pay of those people too. But anyway, I'm getting sidelined.
No, you're not sidelined. You're on a very good track, but this is also, like, how change happens. When change happens, it also ripples out.
Yeah.
And so once you start, you know, like, building that habit in your own organization to pay artists fairly, you cannot not also, like, think about your staff, your colleagues. And we live in a very precarious sector. We work in a very precarious sector that is economically and at times emotionally precarious.
Yes.
So at least, you know, with Frank, what we want to do is really, you know, like support everyone in, you know, bettering their ways of thinking and doing, because some of the behaviorisms and perspectives are really borrowed from 15th century, 18th century, you know, like organizational models. So it is also about like, how can we also align with the values of our times and what it needs? So coming back to like our business model, so we built it on a membership model. So we have very affordable rates, like £4 for an artist to be a member for a year, exactly.
Oh my goodness, because for a year. I was thinking month.
We want quantity. You know, we want a kind of like wider, bigger alignment. But at the moment we have 45 artists who are our members, and we have around 35 public institutions. Their annual contribution is £256. Mm-hmm. And then commercial galleries are £512. And then for funding bodies, we have like, £1,024. It's very, you know, like, as you can see from the maths point, I was like, you know, making a really good budget. But
I love how it's like so exact, like £512. Yes, this makes a lot of sense. And, I, you know, if you break it down, I'm sure you could give every single reason of why that breakdown has happened and what is behind that, which I think is amazing. I think that's so important as well.
Exactly. But, you know, like I estimated that we would have 80, you know, like public organizations and 400 artists instead of, you know, 40 artists. So it would be really good to kind of like really spread the word and get people support us, because our interest is, you know, like to kind of like give back. And we also, you know, like in our guidelines, we talk about transparency. But as a community interest company, we will be following a transparent principle. So everybody will be seeing how much money we receive and where it is spent item by item.
Yeah. Yeah.
And amazing. As directors, you know, like for the last 2 years, we have been doing it as volunteers. So we don't get paid. It's only our project manager and digital comms coordinator that gets paid, which is important.
It sounds like an amazing initiative. And I'm really excited to see, you know, what comes in the future with Frank.
And one thing that I want to add, you know, the reason we called it Frank is we don't want this to be only a project of mine, Anne's, and Lindsay's.
Yeah.
You know, it's a third party organization, so it could actually even decentralize. So there could be multiple Franks operating across the UK. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't have to be about us. It's really about, you know, like the sector and the change that we want to see happen.
Yeah. In line with Frank and the ideas behind that initiative, you are also currently working on a new model for art institutions to be published as a book in 2023, which is this year. Can you tell me a little bit more about that and give some insights into what this new model constitutes?
Absolutely, and with pleasure. And that's another passion project of mine. And it's like literally I feel like I'm attacking the system from all possible directions. So I've been, you know, working with and for institutions throughout my career and always been interested in starting a new institution. So, you know, with experiences at hand on, you know, what works well and what works less well in institutional context, you know, combined with my observation of the international art scene, I think today I'm really sad to say that art institutions are stagnating. They're producing stale programs or generating short-sighted, immediate solutions that actually don't attack the deeper causes of the, you know, stagnation. So my book is really about also looking at, you know, let's say why institutions are stagnating, but not only staying there. Again, as I said, you know, like in the art world, we're so used to kind of like constantly complaining, but I'm interested in finding solutions. And if I'm not the one to find solutions, which is not the most important thing, starting to generate solutions, so perhaps that could lead to finding better solutions together.
Yeah.
You know, so it's again, you know, like being a trigger or catalyst to kind of like, let's start the conversation. I feel like, you know, like this kind of like the idea of a new model started to crystallize in my head already for a long time. But especially over the last 3 years, you know, like the pandemic was so harsh on the art sector, on institutions, on artists, on everyone. But I really feel like there is like a lot of compromises being made, and the current systems and structures that are in place are no longer really supporting institutions to, you know, like honor what they need to be doing in the world, what their function is. So my ambition is in the future to launch this new model, of course, but with like-minded practitioners in the sector. And I hope, you know, like this model initially becomes a catalyst, a kind of like a conversation starter that attacks ideas, positions, needs that are shushed because, you know, like we have to kind of protect the stability or we have to make ends meet or etc. But also engages institutions from, you know, medium to large scale to review and reflect on their systems and structures, their purposeful alignment with the arts, and their organizational behaviorisms.
Is this going to be kind of more, how is this book going to look? Like, this is just kind of like a sidelined question, but is it going to be quite big? Is it quite small? Is it kind of like a handbook? Or is it going to be almost like a textbook style? Or are you even allowed to talk about it before it's out?
Yeah, with pleasure. It's a great question. So this is a mammoth subject.
Yeah.
And so the last 2 years have been for me like a, you know, a marathon of like kind of like trying to bring it into, you know, crystallized form and kind of identify what are the four key areas that institutions need to look at today.
Mm-hmm.
So my chapters are really focusing on the purpose of institutions and also the position of institutions in an environment, in a context where there is an accelerated growth of technology and exponential change in society, as well as I'm looking at organizational structures, you know, operational models, and business models. So it's about how could we support institutions to become more independent, more self-reliant, and less dependent on the dynamics of power, wealth, and private income.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I studied arts administration and cultural policy at Goldsmiths, so I didn't do anything to do with curating. And I feel like this book would be so good as a part of the curriculum. So in case anyone from Goldsmiths is listening, this sounds absolutely wonderful. And when is it due to come out?
Okay, so it was supposed to come out December. We have a bit of a delay. So
okay.
Now it's going to come out in January 2024.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so it's not a big delay. It's from the series called Hot Topics in the Art World. So it is a small book.
You know,
it's not a big book. You can really read in one sitting or in one afternoon.
Okay.
And that series is by Lant Humphreys.
Okay, amazing. I'm going to have to look into that because I'm not familiar with the series, but that,
you must be. Like, Georgina Adams wrote The Rise and the Rise of the Private Museum.
Really?
Hetty Yuda wrote about the How to Work with Mother Artists
and
Other
Parents.
Oh, is that a
part of that series?
Yeah, it's all this,
oh,
like, you know, small books with, like,
okay,
beautiful,
yes,
linen, colorful, yeah, covers.
Oh, my goodness. Wow. Oh, what a dream. Moving on to my next question, an exhibition you curated titled Cascading Principles with works by Conrad Shawcross is currently at the Mathematical Institute in Oxford until October 2023. It combines themes from both arts and sciences, so this is really up your alley, encapsulating philosophy, geometry, and physics with Shawcross's sculptures placed across three floors of the institute. I would love to hear more about this exhibition, especially due to your background in mathematics.
Thank you for this question. So this exhibition has a special point in my heart. So I feel like, you know, 2 decades later, I'm kind of like back in the maths context.
Yeah.
Because I haven't been, even though, you know, as I said, maths have been informing my exhibitions and sometimes my exhibition titles. I've also been very much interested in quantum physics, you know, like
yeah,
curious person trying to understand what reality is from the quantum scale to the classic scale. So Cascading Principles is the largest UK survey exhibition of Conrad Shawcross. And this was not supposed to be that when we started working there. And I have to say, you know, like I find sometimes working outside in art institutional context really inspiring and refreshing because the timelines, procedures and bureaucracies are a bit different. So I can say that like we visited Mathematical Institute, which basically is a Andrew Wiles building that houses all the maths departments from all colleges of Oxford University. Wow. So it's like one giant kind of complex for theoretical geography, geometry, or, you know, like abstract maths, everything, or applicable maths. So when we visited the site in May 2022, there was a lot of excitement in a way that we actually put together a show in 4 months and opened in September 2022.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's an exhibition that's on for more than a year. I feel like we might even expand it because okay. It's been, you know, it's kind of like really well received. And as you said, it's on three floors that kind of like combines public areas and private areas. But you can, if you wanted to, ask the reception for access. So that brings together 17 years of sculptures of Konrad and into the context of the Institute, where the architecture of the Institute is also very peculiar. Mm-hmm. So Paul Vignoli, who actually recently passed away, talked to all the mathematicians what kind of space they needed for their well-being. So some of the skylights is actually mapped according to, you know, Pascal's magic hexagram. And so it's, everything is also already very conceptual and very inspiring. So it was so amazing to kind of like imagine placing sculptures to kind of like almost like triangulate the thinking and impressions between the, you know, the scientific mind and the artistic thought. So to actually kind of like pronounce this further, we've built a four-part lecture series that brings together mathematicians, quantum physicists, artists, architects, philosophers, and it's all about cross-fertilization of thought. So these are very experimental and open-ended lectures or symposia that does not necessarily deliver an idea, but it actually explores the kind of like crossovers, or perhaps like, you know, in a way that explores the potential of us thinking something different in the arts or in the science context.
Yeah.
So the next lecture is on Thursday, actually, and I'm kind of starstruck because I'm moderating a talk with Konrad, mm-hmm. Sir Roger Penrose, who's a Nobel laureate, and he won his Nobel Prize in 2020 on his work about black holes.
Oh, my goodness.
And Carlo Rovelli, who I mentioned, who's a very inspiring quantum physicist, but I really recommend his writing to everyone because it's so accessible, and he talks about these like quite complex ideas and notions that we say space, time, gravity, entropy in a very accessible way, and he's also very much inspired by literature and art.
When I was researching this exhibition, because I knew that we wanted to speak about it, I also recognized a name, Emma Ridgway, who was the curator of the British Pavilion at the Venice Biennale, which also I was just thinking, wow, feeling a bit starstruck and just thinking, oh my God, I would love to listen in. But I think that one is in October, right? That
talk.
So that's coming for those who might be able to go. Definitely look into that.
Absolutely. We have two more lectures. One is on 28th of September, and then the last one is on 5th of October with Emma. And Emma is going to be talking about Ruth Aceva, because Ruth Aceva's work was very topological.
Yeah.
So we wanted to kind of like bring, Ruth Aceva's artistic position and Robin McKay's, you know, like critical philosophical thinking together with, again, the exhibition.
Yeah. Amazing. My penultimate question relates to your advisory roles and being on the jury of some of the most renowned art prizes, such as the Turner Prize. Can you tell me more about your experiences while advising?
Yeah, with pleasure. I mean, you know, I'm interested in supporting artists in many ways as possible. So sometimes through commissioning them for, you know, new works, sometimes, you know, giving them tutorials or mentorship, and sometimes introducing them to colleagues who might actually really like to know that artist's work, or they might collaborate in the future. So being on jury-led positions for me is particularly exciting because not only I kind of continue to support artists, but I also learn from those experiences, because you get exposed to so many different artistic practices and different ways of like looking at art, thinking about art, conceptualizing art. And there is one jury I'm at recently. It's actually from Czech Republic. It's called Jindřich Cholopensky Society. It took me like a couple of years to actually pronounce it, and I'm sure I've terribly pronounced it still, but it's much better. And it's a 3-year jury role that I share with an international array of colleagues like Charles Asher or Yvette Curlin from WHW. And this role is particularly interesting because the prize was initially modeled on Turner Prize, but now with the new director has changed direction. So every year we look at, applications around 150, 170 applicants, and we select shortlist five artists, and they are then, chosen to be supported to produce a new work. And the new work that they make, it becomes part of that award exhibition. And there's not one award winner, but all five wins the award. And throughout that year, we also, as the jury members, do mentoring for these artists. So they tell us about like their process and where they've come. And then we give some critical feedback. And it makes me feel really involved and engaged and invested in their practices, but also, the role itself.
Wow, that sounds really, really fabulous. And being able to work so closely with artists, I think that is such an amazing like foundational support that you're giving. So are these all very contemporary kind of emerging artists? Are these more like established artists? I mean, I guess for the Turner Prize, it's a little bit more established artists. So it's not necessarily like the new contemporaries is very, very new then as well, right? So you have kind of those sides of things. And is the, I'm not going to try and pronounce the name of the prize, I'll let you do that again. But is that something where it's more established artists or like mid-career or emerging?
It's more young artists who have just, graduated or have graduated within the last 3-4 years. It's a bit like new contemporaries in that sense. And I want to say with also Turner Prize, one thing that was interesting is I think it's also about, we didn't get to talk about that much about my practice, but I think I always like to add a kind of an angle to things, you will see that in free sculpture this year, there will be always a bit of a, a twist into the expected plot, which I love, I like surprising people or doing things differently. And even though when I'm, a part of a Turner Prize, which has a set structure and kind of a modality, in my year, which was 2020, we had to change the model. We had to give 10 bursaries instead of choosing 4 artists and then choosing 1 award winner. So I also really liked that. I thought that was actually the most meaningful way of supporting the arts ecology in the UK, to give 10 bursaries of £10,000 worth to artists and artist collectives that are based in London and across the whole country.
Mm-hmm. That sounds really amazing. And one question out of my own curiosity, and also because, to be completely transparent, I think that would be something that I would love to do in the future or think about. How do you approach being able to be on these juries or advisory boards or taking part as being in an advisory role for something like this?
So for me, it's also, again, I initially look at what is the purpose of the, award or the jury, and then see if there's value alignment in there for me. And also it's about, what does it make happen? And if it's something that I want to be associated with. And I'm really interested in, as I said, my understanding of support is unilateral. Yeah. I would like to support people conceptually, practically, especially artists, but also, emotionally. Not that I'm, involved in therapy or anything like that, but it's very important to kind of give encouragement. Or,
absolutely, yeah.
There was one exhibition that I did last year for NADA, New Art Dealers Alliance in New York.
Yeah.
And then it was so interesting because it was a group exhibition of 23 artists. And one of the artists was someone I did a tutorial with at Goldsmiths.
Oh.
And apparently I told him to take risks. And he still remembered and he took risks. And we were you know, we were doing actually a kind of like a Zoom talk with him and then two other artists from the exhibition. And I was like, I met you before, you know, like, yeah. And he was like, yeah, yeah, I was in your tutorial. And I really like that, you know, like I've actually kind of like, you know, left him with an impression that like he could be free from whatever he's thinking and then, you know, take a leap or take more risks.
Yeah.
So I think in that sense, whatever, it's not only the jury roles. I think whatever role I'm involved in, I always check value alignment. And my experiences have also taught me so that it's so crucial for anyone to make sure that whatever you want to surround yourself with is also something that you want to be in.
Yeah. I'm going to move on to my final question, which is kind of a fun one. It's one that I ask all of my guests that come on the podcast. It's kind of a staple. If you could pick one artist from art history to have dinner with, who would it be and why?
I like these kind of questions a lot. And sometimes I kind of like find myself answering that, you know, I think it was like Financial Times weekend, they have this kind of like dinner party sections. I always love it. And sometimes think about like, who would I invite for dinner? So with artists, I actually couldn't really think about, I mean, like I thought about several artists, but if we think widely from art history, if that's okay, my answer would be Marcia Tucker.
Okay.
So she is the founder of New Museum, and I would really recommend everyone to read her autobiography. It is maybe a biography or autobiography. It's called 40 Years of Trouble. And she was quite a pioneer in the art sector, and you know, like she was she was involved in Whitney Museum, MoMA, until she decided that she wanted to change the system and start the new museum as a democratic platform for curatorial department, so that it wouldn't be the director, the genius, you know, like a single director who decides on everything, but it was a collaborative and, you know, like collegiate process. So I would like to actually have dinner with her.
Okay, yeah. Amazing. I will also make sure to check out the book, 40 Years of Trouble.
I think so. Yeah. It's an amazing book. Yeah. It's so inspiring.
Sounds like you're taking inspiration from her a little bit, maybe. In what you're doing.
Definitely. Yeah, yeah.
That's absolutely amazing. Well, Fatosh, that concludes all of my questions. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the podcast and to share your expertise. It was an absolute pleasure.
Same here. Thank you so much for having me and for the wonderful questions and very insightful thinking throughout my career as well. Thanks.
And that is it for today on All About Art. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave me a rating or a review, as it helps more people discover the show. Also, feel free to share with your friends, or if you share on social media, tag me and get in touch. Thank you so much for listening.